With the demise of first mercantile capitalism, and now with industrial capitalism on its ropes everywhere, after having wasted most of the world's vital resources, you'd think the whole stinking drama of greed and mass exploitation would necessarily draw to a close. You'd think there'd be nothing left to huckster. And after having pissed in most of the world's clean drinking water, gutted its forests and its jungles, leveled its mountains for coal and minerals, turned the atmosphere into a blanket of simmering toxins, well, you'd think it was time for the bastards to fold the game and go home with their winnings. No such luck.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Don't we all need a laugh in desperate times? When everything's falling apart, writer Joe Bajant brings it together. His blog is stuffed with tart tirades about the bastards, the rednecks, and the whole cast of our current planetary drama. It's titled after his most famous book, Deer Hunting with Jesus.
The one certainty is that the future will be an entirely different thing than has ever existed. Why? Because the global ecological collapse underway, and now irreversible, is going to change everything, period, for everybody. Nothing like it's ever happened in the past, so the past is completely irrelevant as a basis for assessment. Reading about the collapse of the Mayas won't help much. We ain't Mayas, and there are 6 billion of us munching away and shitting in the same global outhouse now.
I'm Alex Smith. For Radio EcoShock, let's meet Joe Bajant. Hello there.
Hello there.
You know, I can't possibly describe you, Joe. I thought of different things, but would you care to offer our listeners your own thumbnail portrait of yourself? Who are you?
Oh, goodness. Curveball right out of the gate.
You bet.
Well, I don't know. Appalachian redneck born, ex-hippie. Turned into a journalist, traveled around the world, came back to always trying to understand America. I think that's one thing that's been consistent. Probably because I was raised extremely poor in a lower class, and so was always trying to understand why the America I saw every day wasn't the one that was being advertised, and that's sort of what I've written about for almost 30 years.
Well, lately you've written about the millions of people newly freed from the corporate machine. They have lots of holiday time now that they don't have a job. But you seem doubtful that these dispossessed Americans will protest. What will they do with their time when they're broke?
I don't think they can see, you know, what their condition really is. I don't think anybody's really sure the country's broke. They just sort of feel like as individuals they are. They don't understand, but right now we've got millions upon millions that nobody sees. Nobody sees, you know, that are having a very hard time of it. And what will they do? Well, you know, I think that we are becoming a second world nation, so I assume that what will happen is they'll get accustomed to living in a second world nation.
I wonder about the people who've been in a nice suburban house with their kids. They're headed towards a trailer or an RV or maybe a homeless shelter even. They don't have a computer. They may not be part of this conversation we're having now. Maybe it could be a bit liberating to get out of the yoke of the net that encompasses us all.
Well, what's interesting is that if you look, you know, at what health care, we're number 37, our quality of life, quality of so many things is gone. And even in many respects, you know, we already are a second world nation. I mean, my Lord, you know, 75% of the national gross national product will be for debt in a few years. And people don't really believe it because they look around and we still have that thin, clear, commercial plastic skin over everything. The infrastructure is still stuck together. The houses still have their new plastic siding. And so this illusion, this consumer reality, you know, says, oh, no, we're not in that bad a shape. Just look, cars are shiny, and so on. But it's a hollow economy, of course. You know, the percentage of people that live on less than a dollar a day during the last 18 years has dropped by 44% because all the jobs are there now, not here. But the people living in a hollow economy don't know that. all they know is, well, I get up every morning, the coffee maker starts, I still got wireless, everything must be all right. But really, it's a zombie economy.
A zombie economy. Well, there have been the poor in America for a long time. It shocked me as a Canadian. I went down to a Florida RV park, and there's a 40-foot bus with all the options, and right beside it, a 10-foot trailer. And in the trailer is an 8-year-old girl who can't eat a carrot because her teeth are so bad, and they're moving every 2 weeks. They get kicked out every 2 weeks to go to another. So she's not going to school or anything. So is this just more of the same, or is America in for a new shock about how it's become?
Well, you know, America's always needed an underclass, and the bottom of an underclass is called damn poor, you know. And they don't see it. People don't travel in the circles where you see it. We all run our little causeways to and from the job and the mall or whatever our life is made of, the university. But we've always had a lot of poor whites. I think that's the thing that nobody can quite grasp, because the media, because culture and media is in urban centers, we naturally see, you know, minorities and so on. But what we haven't seen is a permanent white underclass that's been here since World War II, at least. Well, if you want to count people in the Dust Bowl or the 4 million poor Southerners who needed liberation as much as the slaves did. They've always been around. They've always been the rough side down of the economy. And now there's more of them, you know, but they've always been around. We don't have to take the most dramatic homeless example. You go into the cheap cracker box modular homes, you know, with the box of ho-ho cakes, you know, on the crummy particle board table and the TV going. And this is the poverty of the mind, you know, the lack of education, the millions upon millions that can't read at any kind of a functional level, much less a credit card contract. They've always been here, and that number is growing. You know, I was raised in it, so I know, you know, we've always been here. And everywhere I go, I find us, whether it's Springfield, Oregon, or Rome, New York, or whatever. And we've always been here. Now it's coming back to bite the middle class in the ass.
I read another scary piece of yours, first published on Alternet, August 10th, titled, "Corporations Are Now After Our Very Beings." What do you mean by that?
You mean that was the one about consciousness, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, as our experience has become more digital, more removed from reality, more imagistic, more involvement, more time with screens, more time with the hyperbolic images and spectacle. People's expectations and understanding of the physical material earth becomes farther and farther removed. That's what I tried to talk about in the last chapter of the previous book. It's just like a hologram, you know, and everything has to be more entertaining, more spectacular. For instance, we couldn't discuss health care. We couldn't sit down and say, okay, let's look at high blood pressure medicine, which I take. Let's look at these things. Instead, because of the need for spectacle in a nation of conditioned consumers looking for gratification higher and higher, it had to be about death panels, you know, because that's what titillates, that's what excites. And very quickly, the discussion became, you know, reached that high level of hyperbole, because the people are no longer capable of the attention span that it takes to conduct rational, critical thinking. In fact, I'm not sure they have the tools.
Well, and we're lacking the memory. I mean, we don't remember that it was Ben Bernanke and the Fed who brought us into this mess, and now they're sort of giving him a pat, good job, Brownie, and putting him back in the chair. We don't remember even what he was saying then when he said there was no problem.
We don't even remember whole wars. Gulf War, Angola. I had somebody the other day that was 24 when it was when Angola was going on. The guy's an attorney. And he was 24 then. He said, oh, yeah, Angola. Didn't they have missiles or something? The national memory. I just did a chapter in the new book called The Sediment of Memory about a set of studies that were done that show that memory starts to decay, both personal and national, immediately when the event happens, and that Elizabeth Loftus was the famous researcher that proved it. And immediately, all outside factors, even if they're not trying to be suggestive, start to replace it. And a personal story is built, or a national storyline is built, and the memory is eroded. And some things, they just disappear. And it's a very interesting phenomenon because it's kind of, from a national standpoint, rather new. And it's because we have so much media to make those suggestions.
And you suggest capitalism can rent us a prefigured consciousness, even a green consciousness, if you want, with labels telling the world just how green I am, you know. Maybe we could even buy an anti-corporate consciousness.
Well, they do every day. You know, capitalism is an amazing thing. It can co-opt anything. The first time I ever noticed that was in the 60s when the revolution became the Dodge Revolution. And that's what it does. If anybody's interested in it, they turn around and they sell it to you. I mean, you ever try to buy some hemp fiber clothing? Look at the cost, you know. It's no matter what people's desires are, the object of capitalism is to extract money from people. So they extract it on the basis of that desire. There is no such thing as buying green. You know, solar generators, wind, wonderful stuff. But think about what a solar panel takes out of the earth to make it. Or the digital things that operate or regulate it. Think about what our laptop does or our cell phone. I mean, it starts and ends either in the soil or under the soil, and that's the thing that people are not able to do because they've been transfigured by digital media, by electronics, and so on. And so they live in a hologram, images of images of images of images, many, many times removed. What kind of a practical consciousness can you have when you operate that way?
You've also said the global ecological collapse underway is now irreversible and that we've never seen anything like it. That brings up two questions for me. Why is it irreversible, and should we just give up and start drinking heavy?
Well, I haven't done that. But I have never met, you know, what we get for public consumption. Okay, you can go buy all the wonderful books about how we're going to fix it. But they're products, remember. And you're buying them because somebody is sating your desire for a profit. That speaker that's getting $5,000 or whatever, you know, Arianna Huffington or whatever, selling ads because some people are liberal, some people are conservatives. But I have yet to meet, a person that is a professional scientist involved in that. I have yet to meet one that says it's reversible. I have scarcely met any that said it's arrestable. As long as we have 6 billion people, that'll be 12 billion people in very few years, it's not reversible, is it?
Well, we can't all go back to growing organic vegetables. There isn't enough room for that number of people to leave what seems to be a mechanized consciousness now. I wonder, have we evolved into a dependence on this corporate feeding tube, or is it devouring us?
Well, we can be dependent on it, and we are dependent on it. The global corporatized system dominates the needs hierarchy from top to bottom, at every level. Try to think of something. I mean, like I always say, the varnish on this floor, the clothes I wear, the guitar that's standing in the corner, the food in the refrigerator itself, the coffin I'll be buried in, all of these come from corporations. We can envision no other way for the world to become manifest. But given the number of people and the population, I don't know, I know some pretty heavy hitters that say, well, undoubtedly you're looking at a series of diebacks. You know, whether it's through warfare or starvation or disease, you know, a series of them, not just some huge cataclysmic thing that cuts it back to a billion or so, something that's a little more sustainable. But, you know, the other thing is, too, and I've been chided for it, and I apologize, you know, when we say the world's overpopulated, therefore it's irreversible until, even if we disappeared tomorrow, it would never, Mother Nature doesn't care, it would just make something else happen. But I've been chatted for making it sound like too many people, that it's Africa and Latin America's fault. No. A 24-year-old man in America, single, uses more of the earth up than 16 farming families in India. You know, so I wanted to make that point, you know, that it is the sheer numbers, yes, but we have a responsibility, just personally. You know, we don't have to have, you know, oh, my God, if we all do everything right, then it's all going to be all right. Well, America is cupcake land. It's never going to be all right again. But we can do the right thing. You know, I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm eating organically and you know, using very little of things these days because it makes me feel better. We do have a conscience. We do have a belief in justice and balance. And at least we can act on that as human beings.
You've got Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. We're talking with Joe Bajan, blogger and author of the best-selling book Deer Hunting with Jesus, A Disturbing Portrait of the American Underclass.
America is one big yard sale now as we close out the books on industrial capitalism, only to discover that all our neighbors were as broke as we were, that it was all on the plastic, the furniture, the wines, the digital toys, the camping gear we never used. There's something eerily sad in these tens of thousands of suburban Saturday morning sales. There are seldom any buyers, not even many free box takers, only sellers. An uncharacteristic silence hangs in the air, and there's a feeling of some unspoken recent disaster of immense proportion, some Chernobyl-like thing that left everything standing. Population growth is the rhino in the playpen, the root cause of our approaching eco-disaster that no one honestly talks about. On the left, we get an onslaught of information about what we must do and must not do to stop climate change. Good Democrats get Al Gore's advice, which somehow never mentions the corporations doing the damage. And all of America gets feel-good electric car ads. Buy your way out of the problem. Or at least your guilt, if you happen to have any. But nowhere do we get an honest discussion about population growth. You can argue that climate change may or may not destroy us, but uncontrolled population growth is guaranteed to do the job.
You've written in defense of rednecks while mocking urban liberals. Now that Georgia's drying out and Texas seems about to shrivel up, is there a backcountry recognition, do you sense it, that the climate is screwed?
Backcountry, you mean?
Yeah, I mean outside of the liberals and the cities on their computers. Are people who are right on the land, do you think they're getting it?
Well, they're kind of in the suburbs in the heartland now. I use the term rednecks. I embrace it. I am one, and it's the name of a culture, among other things. And I think that they are aware that something is terribly wrong. For instance, when we saw all those red-faced people screaming, went to one of those healthcare things recently, and three people were wearing guns. Of course, if you ask them, they would say, oh, it's my Second Amendment rights. But really, something much more ominous is going on. And the screaming and the hysteria and the unthought-out, irrational theatrics that we saw are the release of an incomprehension and an anger and anxiety going on. You know, somebody just propped them up there and pressed their button because they don't have a language to describe where their problems are really coming from. But, everybody feels it. Everybody's afraid. Nobody talks about it, you know. I mean, at the lowest level, yeah, it's fishing and hunting. At the middle level, it's, I think everybody in America senses that the ground has shifted under us, that nobody knows its name, you know. Well, we know its name, you know. It's the collapse of capitalism as we've known it, American-style capitalism.
And I wonder, how long do you think we'll wallow in these false promises of recovery before something really important cracks open? Do you think you and I will live to see the Great Correction?
No. You know, I don't think so. You know, there is no recovery in the sense, you know, yeah, the housing market's going to come back like it was. We're all going to be doing the same thing, you know, as we did before. Obviously, it proved unsustainable. Obviously, it proved to be a bubble that when it broke, shattered everything around it, you know. But given that people, this is the only consciousness they have. This is the only world they've known, the one that they were raised in a corporate state. Personally, I know he wouldn't get reelected, but I would much have preferred to see Obama stand up, name it the way it really is, and at least, I know a lot of urban liberals and super conservatives especially wouldn't buy it, or they wouldn't want to buy it, but we all know what the truth is. Common sense tells us what's sustainable. I would rather he be noble and right than be in bed with the snakes he's with.
Could you tell us a bit about your new book?
Well, it's masquerades as a memoir, but it's really about the creation of a permanent white underclass in America after World War II. 45% of Americans lived on farms before World War II, but by 1960, only 6% did. But I found out from a guy at Johns Hopkins, and it just set me off, that it was a purposeful forced migration out of rural America into the cities to sustain the wartime economy. Corporations and large entities, and including, you know, FDR, did not want to see all the money that they had made during the war suddenly stop. The war boom was the answer to the Depression. DuPont wanted to keep on selling nylon that had used for Jeep tires and parachutes. And to do that, they had to, A, get more consumers, get them to working, get them a paycheck, get them off those basically subsistence farms. They weren't poor. They lived okay. They didn't have much money. And it was pretty much a forced migration, forced through economic devices. But I read the old stock reports, share reports for DuPont, and they said, we're going to have to move these people out of the country. Out of the countryside. We're going to have to get them to buy things they don't really want. We have to have the government's cooperation in making this new American lifestyle that consumes these things. And I fell over when I read it because I know my family was part of that migration.
Good book on that, the DuPont dynasty. Great big thick book, hard to find, but well worth reading. Well, as we wrap up, if I hand you an open mic, which my brain tells me could be a dangerous idea, is there anything else that you'd like to rant about?
No. I sound like I'm ranting because I'm trying to compress a lot of things in talking now. But, you know, I do believe that hope is mystical thinking. Knowing the facts allows you to deal with things, you know. That's all. I mean, look at things for what they really are.
Good advice from Joe Bagent. His blog is titled, after his famous book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. You can find his latest essays at joebagent.com, spelled J-O-E, obviously, B-A-G-E-A-N-T.com, and look for his upcoming book. It's A Tonic for the Dimming Soul. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much, Joe, for joining us.
Thank you.
Green 960 listeners can download the extended interview with Joe Bagent, mixed with quotes from his blog, in the EcoShock Features section of our audio on-demand menu at the website ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for tuning in.